Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Ian Smith, deputy companies editor. How are you doing, Ian?
Fine, John. How are you doing?
Not bad. Mark Robinson.
Hello, John.
How are you, Mark?
Oh, very well, thank you.
And Alex Newman. How are you, Alex?
Good. Good afternoon, John.
Excellent. So, yeah, we got lots of the magazine this week. It's the 20th anniversary of AIM, and Alex is going to be talking about that very shortly. Mark's going to be discussing BP's statistical yearbook for 2014, I think it is, and the outlook for world energy markets. But before we come on to that and the cover feature, which is about reassuringly expensive shares, we're going to have a quick chat about the news this week. Ian, what have we got going on?
Well, where do we start? I think that probably the most important figure this week was 2.7%, which was the increase in average weekly pay in the 3 months to April, which far outstripped economists' expectations and is further evidence of a strengthening economic recovery and crucially actually just trickling down finally to workers' pay packets.
Simon mentions that it's the eighth month in succession where we've seen wage rises radically outstripping inflation.
Especially as cost of living was obviously a big part of the political debate prior to the election, and just the idea that with the amount of money that was poured into the banking sector, which then led to severe cuts on public services, workers were just not feeling the benefits of the recovery in pay increases. And if you, especially if you compare it to the inflationary environment that we have, that's a pretty good rise.
Okay, good news for retailers then, potentially, but we'll come on to that in a minute. I mean, there were some inflation figures out as well. So I think a month ago we spoke about deflation, but that's gone now.
Yeah, it was a brief dip, as many people predicted it would be. And we're back into slight inflation, 0.1%.
But I guess the worry or possibility remains that, you know, with wages rising quickly and the oil price bouncing back, we could start to see some much punchier inflation figures in the months ahead.
Yes, but we're still quite a long way below the 2% target level, Bank of England. But yeah, very much the prediction has been that the inflation will rise back towards that towards the end of this year into the beginning of next year. But yeah, that's always going to be there's always a fear, isn't there, whichever way it's going.
Okay, nothing to worry about yet, but definitely something to keep an eye on, I suspect.
Yeah, it's the major other news story this week, obviously, is still going on in Greece. Just kind of further bad news. Equity markets kind of stalked by the fear of Grexit. And we talk about it each week, so we don't want to labour the point. But the key figure there is this €1.5 billion payment that is due to the IMF at the end of the month. So last-ditch negotiations continue. There always seems to be a last ditch, and then beyond that, there's another ditch.
Yeah,
I'm sure there'll be a final ditch at some point.
It does seem that we're getting to that final ditch now when it comes to Greece.
Yeah, I think that's the key date. I think it's June the 30th, and that this payment has to be made. I'm sure there is some political fudge that can yet be done.
Well, we've been saying that for a while. I'm not so sure. I heard this morning on the radio that the Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras' wife, had threatened to divorce him if he gave any concessions to the EU. So,
I mean, tough times at home. And then the Finance Minister, did you know that his wife is believed to be the lady from Common People? She came from Greece. She had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College.
The pulp.
And apparently the only person that studied sculpture at St. Martin's College from Greece at that time is the other half of the finance minister. There you go.
What significance the Syriza party has had on our lives. I mean, we talk about this jokingly, but, you know, Syriza was elected on a mandate of basically going head to head with the EU. I mean, you know, this is
almost an impossible mandate. Yeah,
it's an impossible mandate, but you know, they can't, to my mind, really be compliant with the demands of the Troika, as it were. I mean, it just seems a disaster waiting to happen, as we've said all along.
Yeah, I mean, when I said I think there could be a political fudge, I more meant around the deadline rather than there'll be some fudge that will, you know, patch it all back together. I agree that there's just so much of a gulf in between the very left-wing party that's promised not to enact any of the reforms, or probably enact a very small amount, and its international creditors, which want far-reaching economic reforms.
And set against the determination of European politicians to keep the Eurozone together.
Yeah, exactly right. It's hard to see exactly how it's going to all come to a speedy resolution. But yeah, we'll keep tabs on that.
Okay. Okay, we've been keeping tabs on it for a while, but we don't talk about it much because. But I think, yeah, this is going to really affect the markets, and it actually already has been affecting the markets quite seriously. I mean, you look at the FTSE over the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's in a big downtrend.
Yeah, big downtrend. I think that's the reason to keep talking about it is because it does seem to be now really starting to affect the markets. Obviously, European equities have had a good run this year, but we're seeing some quite tough, you know, red numbers, aren't we?
Indeed. Do you think that the FTSE's weak performance is the result of Greece, or do you think other factors are at play?
I think that's a lot of it, but I do think also the uncertainty in the bond markets, which is something else that we've written about this week, that kind of sell-off, I think that kind of sentiment might be feeding across as well.
So this was your piece that you are the lead piece in the news section? Aberdeen readies for a fall?
Yeah, so basically... there's some figures from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, actually their EPFR figures, showing there was a $5.9 billion outflow from bonds in the week to the 10th of June, which is the largest weekly outflow in 18 months. So that just shows that, you know, investors getting out of bonds, and that is something that worries fixed income managers, obviously. Aberdeen has taken out a $500 million, well, some credit lines, so it hasn't actually drawn the credit, but it's set up credit facilities in case there's mass redemptions from its bond funds. And it's something that BlackRock, reportedly, according to Bloomberg, has already kind of ramped up the amount that its mutual funds can collectively borrow in the case of redemptions. So obviously you have the major fund houses that are starting to get worried that this... this kind of stuttering sell-off that we've seen in the bond market is going to really start to hit them, because the big fear for fixed income investors is the liquidity or a lack of it in the bond market. And that's what people have been talking about for a while in the institutional investment world, especially. It's been talked about for a while, but perhaps that might come to a head if we start to see a real big sell-off feeding through into big fund redemptions.
You've got to wonder. So the money's being taken out of the bond markets. It doesn't seem to be flowing into the equity markets. We know it's coming out of emerging markets too. I mean, where is the money going?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen, obviously, what's been popular over the past couple of years has been alternative assets, especially fixed income alternatives. I haven't got the figures to hand on the fund flows, but yeah, definitely alternatives has been something that's been quite popular. Also, risk mitigation strategies, with equity markets seen as a kind of, you know, 6-7 year highs.
It might be illustrating as well if we, in the coming weeks, have a look at the cash positions of fund managers at the moment as well. That's always a very good pointer. I covered this about 8 months ago, but I should be doing it over the next week, and I can make a pledge to our listeners that I'll come back with something meaningful next week.
I'd like to hear that, because it wouldn't surprise me if we're seeing a lot more people moving into cash and sitting on it. Because, or as you say, in wealth preservation.
Mm. Have a look at gold.
Gold's bounced a little bit. Certainly holding steady. And I saw a chart today that suggested it was hitting a breakout level.
Yeah, I mean, it's been bobbing around that $1,200 mark for a long time now, which we've said in the past is the all-in sort of production cost there for gold. There's a possibility, though, say Ian mentioned before, if inflation starts to creep back into the system, you know, that's obviously supportive for gold prices over the rest of the year. We're broadly sort of positive on them.
Tricky times for investors to navigate.
Indeed.
But, you know, tricky times though they may be, there's one market that has cause for celebration, and that's the AIM market. Alex, you've been looking at it this week, and I think you spoke to the boss of that market.
I did, yeah. Happy birthday, AIM. It's 20 this week, and for a secondary feature this week, we interviewed Marcus Stuttard, who's the chief of AIM. But he, I guess, now wants it to be seen, or indeed says that investors see it on a par with the main market. Of course, that's debatable.
Yeah, I think that's not really true.
I think there, you know, there's a lot going in AIM's favour, and for many of our investors, it is the most exciting part of the market. I mean, to my mind, at least, you won't get a company tripling in value in the FTSE 100 within the space of a couple of years, but they occasionally crop up on AIM. So there's a lot of excitement in the market, but if you had put £100 into AIM when it launched 20 years ago, on the 19th of June 1995, I think you'd be looking at about £85 in your pocket now. So it's been not a great returning index or market, but, you know, there are some fantastic stories there, and, you know, it's not going away anytime soon.
Well, I guess the argument there is that this is not an index you would buy to track. It's an index, it's a stock picker's market. So, you know, it's a place where small companies with great potential come to raise some money. You know, a shrewd investor might be able to pick the best of them, and, you know, by concentrating their investment in a few companies, could make a lot of money buying the index not necessarily the way to play AIM.
Indeed, and Marcus Stothard admitted as much to us when he said it is a stock picker's market. The worry for some investors is that the light touch regulation or the lighter touch compared to the main market is a danger, and that sometimes there is not enough protection from the, I guess, fly-by-night companies we sometimes worry about, where there is either a conflict of interest between the nomad, which acts as both the broker to the shares and the advisor to the company, and small retail investors, and that there also may not be as much protection for retail shareholders from off-market capital raisings, which can dilute share prices quite heavily and is more of a symptom of AIM than it is the main market. So,
well, AIM is an unusual regulatory arrangement. It's essentially self-regulated. So the regulator of AIM is the London Stock Exchange, which is, I guess, the ultimate financial beneficiary of companies coming to market on AIM.
Yeah, and they're not looking to put the handbrake on attracting new companies to the market anytime soon. China has been one of the more worrying jurisdictions for companies or company listings on AIM in the last few years. But Mr. Stothard was keen to still look at businesses that might want to float on AIM in China. Elsewhere, they're very focused on North America and Europe as well. So that there is a lot more to come from emerging markets as well as the more mature ones.
I mean, playing devil's advocate, why on earth would a North American company want to list on AIM rather than the markets of North America, where there is a much more active retail investor base, lots of money floating around?
I spoke with one company, which Adgorithms, which just floated on AIM, which is an Israeli ad tech business with an artificial intelligence proprietary software. It's quite an interesting company. They said if they had floated on NASDAQ, where a lot of ad tech startups are found, they'd have been swamped there, and they would have the expectations would have been too high. AIM allows them to grow at a steadier rate, perhaps with slightly less expectation than NASDAQ. Sorry, the liquidity of the pink slips can be a bit of an issue for some companies which don't regard the investor base quite as mature as AIM, but also not as combative as the full market for tech stocks in the US NASDAQ. So it's a sweet spot, arguably, but it also is also cheaper to list on AIM. So we should bear that in mind.
And cheaper because it doesn't have the same regulatory burden that other markets have.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my view, as I've written in the editorial this week, is that, I think we have to accept that a kind of lighter touch regulatory arrangement may sometimes cause problems. But AIM is a good thing, and it has been a good thing. There's some great companies that have come through the AIM market. You list a few in the future. I mean, someone like ASOS had a few problems recently, but I mean, it's an undeniable success story. And, 20 years on, AIM's still here. The Neue Markt, which was Germany's attempt at it, didn't survive. And actually, I think there's talk even of them trying again. But undeniable success story, but a lot of work to go potentially to overcome some of these regulatory concerns that people have about it.
Well, the problem as well, if you look at the total return over the period as well, the market has been heavily weighted towards resource stocks as well and startup resource stocks.
Yeah, so,
That was always a problem, and it was always said of AIM that it was a very good primary market but very poor secondary market. But when you look at it, since the changes to tax regulations, that secondary market has actually picked up now. There's quite a bit more liquidity in it. And given the attrition that we've had, particularly with resource stocks over the last couple of years, you could actually make the argument that it's a higher quality market now than it was 18 months, 2 years ago.
Well, I think that's an argument we've made several times. We often cover the AIM market. We do our AIM 100 roundup over 2 weeks every year. Look at that, you look at the kind of companies certainly among the top 100 largest companies on AIM. And, you've got a very broad spread across sectors. You've got some very mature companies. Some companies that have been around for hundreds of years, even.
Well, exactly. And the point is, when you look at second boards right around the world, there is a history where they haven't actually outperformed the main benchmark. But they're not there to do that. They're there to provide a financing for smaller companies that won't be able to raise it through tertiary finance or on the main market itself.
Absolutely. But Alex, you spoke to a company called Athenry Trust, and that was one of the original 10 that was there at the beginning, 1995.
Yeah, so still listed. So Robin Boyle, who is the fund manager of Athelney Trust, specifically invests in small caps and counts a number of AIM companies in the portfolio he manages. He was one of the first 10 constituents of AIM. He doesn't really mince his words in the short interview we did with him about the quality of what he sees as some of the businesses. But to back up, I guess, Mr. Stothard's point about the differences between the main market and AIM, he says he doesn't primarily look at which market a company is on when he looks at the investment case. Obviously, that'll factor in at some point, but he will look at a company based on its quality and its earnings profile first, then look at the regulation that underpins it. So I mean, and he's been in the market since the very start. So the fact that he is wary of many of what he calls some of the spiffy boards that exist, he still sees a lot of value there, as do we.
Yeah,
and we'll continue to follow it closely.
Absolutely. So we can definitely see AIM being around for another 20 years. Then
I'm sure.
Absolutely. I'm sure. Yeah. No, I think his point is a good one. I mean, Simon Thompson, who is our small cap stock picking expert, he obviously picks a lot of companies from AIM, but I don't think that's his primary driver. He looks at the small cap, the fledgling indices, and it's about looking at the numbers and seeing where the value is. So I think in that respect, AIM is indeed on a par with some of its larger brethren. For me, certainly the regulatory thing is odd. I think that needs looking at. But there you go. There you go. Okay, I mean, Robert, you mentioned resource shares. I've obviously, been, as you say, a big constituent of AIM over recent years and largely responsible for its shoddy performance in the last two or three. You've done a big review of BP's statistical yearbook this year. So, are things going to be looking up for the resource constituents of AIM and the main markets?
Well, not really with the energy stocks, and we shouldn't really be surprised. The main takeaway when you look at this statistical review, which is the market looks to as something of a benchmark for the industry in a way, is that primary energy demand isn't keeping up with GDP. So what's the implication there? Well, there's a number of them, as it turns out. The main one that we seem to have locked into is China's transition from a heavily industrialized country to one with a larger service sector. I mean, it is still accounts for a lot of the world's sort of heavy industry, steelmaking and whatnot. But it's a central plank of Beijing's policy now, which will see that economy turning to a more consumer-based economy over the next couple of decades. And it's already coming through. You look at it now as well, we've seen a fall away in energy growth over the last years, but what that also means is that the renewable sector is far more prominent. And when you look at it, what caught me, well, what was particularly interesting is that about 6% of worldwide power generation is down to renewable sources now, and it accounted for a third of the increase in primary energy use last year. So, I mean, that's fairly significant, I think. There was a few other takeaways as well. The fact that India might be able to take up some of China's slack because under the Modi government now, they're making some steady progress in regulatory issues.
So we're talking steelmaking here.
Yeah, steelmaking.
And that's good for coal.
Well, exactly. And India wants to triple its steel production capacity in fairly short order as well. And to do this, the Modi government has changed some of the sort of onerous planning obstacles in India, and so we're quite confident in that regard that it will be able to take up at least some of the slack as China transitions to a different kind of economy. We also point out, or the report points out, that nuclear fuel was an important component last year. In the wake of Fukushima, obviously, I point to it as the fuel source that dare not speak its name. Mm. But it's going through one of these temporary areas where its reputation in the public is gradually coming back, because there's plenty of environmentalists now who say that we won't be able to sort of meet present emission targets by the use of green energies, and looking forward, nuclear will be part of the global energy mix to meet these targets if politicians are actually serious about it. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they are over the long run.
Indeed. And so confident are you. You've actually tipped a uranium producer this week, haven't you? Don't tell us who it is.
Oh, yes, I have. Yeah. It's a pure play, if you like, on that market rebounding and prices rebounding.
Looking very depressed in terms of valuation against its historic averages.
Oh, exactly. And, actually, prices for yellow cake have increased over the last 6 months, but longer term, there's every reason to think that it's going to move into a fairly large deficit in the next couple of years. We've mentioned this about copper as well. In a fairly unpromising resource complex as a whole, those two stand out, I think.
I guess the big takeaway for me was the view of Bob Dudley, who's the boss of BP, and he's basically saying that we can expect price volatility more than anything else in the years ahead.
Yeah, and to give him credit as well, he was saying much the same thing at the beginning of 2014 as well. I mean, he's been around long enough to know that it can actually be an extremely volatile part of the market. It's just that we had a period for about 10 years, or 15 years rather, where Asia-Pacific demand was growing at such a rate that we took on a general assumption that, you know, this is going to last forever, but of course it never does. And his comments are backed up by some research from the World Energy Council that we had a look at as well, that it seems to suggest that, you know, volatility will become a permanent feature of the energy markets for the time being. This is great for the traders themselves, but obviously with our readers, they'll be looking at this with a degree of trepidation, I guess. I would say that looking ahead, you've got to look at the stocks that offer better growth potential over the long term, and that's why we're reasonably positive on Shell's approach for BG, because it's buying into a thematic issue, i.e. the continued rise of LNG and natural gas as a fuel generating source.
It's also buying at the bottom of the cycle.
Cycle, and quite unusual with the resource stocks as well. But it's worth actually getting hold of a copy of this if you go into BP's website itself, and you can look at it in a little bit more detail. Last year, 2014, going into this year, is probably one of the most significant years in energy markets in some time. And naturally, we look at the growth of unconventional sources in the US. Everyone's well aware of this now. And again, we point to the fact that a lot of the price levers nowadays aren't actually linked to market fundamentals, but to geopolitical issues as well.
Yeah, I'm still intrigued by this idea that we discussed last week. In fact, Alex's feature regarding energy efficiency.
You can see it certainly in developed economies.
But developing economies like China, I mean, you know, they're not just, you know, shifting to a consumer economy. They're shifting to a consumer economy that actually pays attention to the amount of fuel it uses in its cars and its electricity supply. I mean, we're not just burning energy willy-nilly as we did in the past.
No, that's it. And with China as well, there's a concerted effort from Beijing to improve the air quality. It's become an economic issue in the country as well. So they'll be going to more gas-fired power stations. They've already done this in a lot of the coastal towns there, and there's some evidence to suggest that they're making real progress.
Indeed.
And I did point out as well that I think in here somewhere, if you look at Japan and the changes to oil consumption, it's at lowest level in Japan since 1971, which is extraordinary.
I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating statistic.
And a lot of this is down to improved fuel efficiency, for one thing, and we see this in European markets and we see it in the US. It's only in emerging economies where it isn't quite at that level yet.
So talking of energy efficiency, might be a good segue into the company news this week, because one company we mentioned last week in our energy efficiency feature, Flow Group, the efficient boiler company, has had a bit of a nightmare this week.
They've had a very bad week. It's gone off the boil, if you...
very good.
There was a ruling on the 4th of June. It took until this Tuesday, so there was a bit of a lag for Flow Group to issue the response to the ruling, which was that a European court found the UK government's decision as part of the Green Deal in the last coalition government to reduce the VAT on energy-efficient products The ECJ found that to be in breach of EU VAT rules. Probably plays pretty well into UKIP's hands, because it's sort of the perfect example of Brussels asking for energy efficient measures to be taken at the same time, clamping down on governments when they may introduce a measure to aid that. So it's certainly been a headache for Flow Group, which has had to drastically cut its expectations for boiler installations this year. The shares were down 40% nearly on the news.
Yeah. So I was a bit sceptical last week when we spoke about this on the radio. Not for that reason, which I must admit I was blissfully unaware of. But more generally about, you know, what kind of boilers customers would buy. And I'm going with Worcester Bosch. So sorry, yeah. Flow Group.
but it ties into your point, because the 15% increase in VAT that Flow Group expects this to amount to. So it was at a 5% artificial rate that the Green Deal had set. Now it's expected to jump back up to the normal 20% VAT rate. That would add £500 to the price of the boiler. So I think you were talking about the sheer cost as well.
They're pricey.
This boiler. So revolution has been stalled for at least half a year.
No, shame. As I said, I wish it every success. I think, you know, it would be good to have a British company competing in this space. You know, every home's got to have a new boiler every now and then. And at the moment, it's Valent and Worcester Bosch. Okay, so Ian, results. What we got in the results section that's particularly interesting this week?
It was good results season for, well, it continues to be so, for house builders. We have Barclay Group and Crest Nicholson both reporting this week. And what we're seeing really is that average selling prices for houses have risen quite considerably, and that's driving the profits. It's reasonably simple, really. I mean, Barclay Group actually sold fewer homes in 2015 than it did in 2014 financial year, and yet its operating profit grew by 40% to just over £500 million.
And we're still positive on those, I take it?
Yeah, we both have them both on a buy. They've both done well. They're both on full buy tips, and they've done well.
Yeah, we've stuck with that house builder trade perhaps longer than some people thought we should have, and it's been vindicated, that stance.
Yeah, I just think the secular arguments for it quite strong, aren't they?
Absolutely, I think there's more to come. Surely, more to come. Agreed. House building is just not. We don't build too many houses,
and the ones that we do are quite expensive.
Indeed. I mean, in terms of valuation, how are they looking?
Yeah, they're not looking too expensive. We can see the PE ratio for Barclays 11, 12 for Crest Nicholson. So we see further upside, and crucially, they've done well compared to our tips. So we're happy.
Interestingly, though, the cover feature this week is about companies that perhaps, you know, don't exhibit those on the face of it very cheap valuations, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But one of the companies that pops up in that cover feature, reassuringly expensive, was Halma, and they had some results this week that looked pretty nice.
Yeah, adjusted operating profit was up by a tenth, £159 million. It was 12th consecutive year of record revenue and profit, which is pretty good, isn't it?
And everything seems to be moving in the right direction there on an almost permanent basis. I mean, it's an extraordinary company.
Yeah, and a very diverse one as well. And I think that's probably helping its share price, which, as you can see from the graph in the story, has had a pretty good run.
Yeah, I mean, this is an example. I mean, reading Harriet's piece, Harriet Russell, who wrote the feature, you know, one of the characteristics of that company, which I really like, and I think, you know, we should always be on the lookout for this, is, you know, it constantly is on the lookout for new businesses to bolt on through acquisition, and to move into new areas where it thinks there's value to be had, very specialist areas, and I love that in companies. You know, Big Bet, the farm acquisitions, which we occasionally see, I'm always wary of, but you know, these businesses that can buy and build like this, I think they're fantastic, and Halma's a great example of that. Another example of a company which hasn't necessarily gone down the buy and build strategy, which is reassuringly expensive, which we feature on the broker page this week, is Ted Baker, which had an amazing week. Expensive shares, but you know, they just keep on going. I mean, it's an extraordinary company in the retail fashion business.
We've kept them on a buy, even though I think their forward PE ratio is something like 28 times this year. But the rate of growth over the last 4 years has been pretty astounding. I think they're forecast by one of the brokers to grow at a compound annual growth rate of 18% over the next 3 years. So they are unafraid of taking on the world, it seems. They're opening up outlets all over North America, the Middle East, and now they're going into Asia. Their wholesale business is doing really well. I think their e-commerce business was up by nearly a half. Yeah, it's all going great guns for Ted Baker.
You know, and you said earlier, Alex, that you know you don't see on the main market companies travelling in value in, you know, two or 3 years. I remember the share price of Ted Baker is now 2,850p, 28.5 quid. I tipped this as a tip of the year, probably about 5 years ago, and it was £4.50 at the time.
I eat my words. Ten minutes later, it does happen.
You know, but even then, I remember looking at the shares thinking, they're not cheap. Here we are, 5 or 6 years later. And, you know, the shares have risen five or six fold in value, you know. Sevenfold in value.
Well, to qualify from my earlier point, it was FTSE 100 companies, but I mean Ted Baker at this rate, you know, will soon be entering that bracket because I think it's slightly below the FTSE 100.
Indeed, I mean, you know, again, this business I like. You know, you talked about internationalisation, not afraid to take on the world, but it has approached that in a very sensible fashion. So, you know, when we looked at this 5 or 6 years ago, yeah, it was dabbling internationally, but it wasn't going all guns blazing into international markets. And I think it's, you know, it's taken its time, consolidated its position, and then realised when it had the strength to move overseas. And, for me, this is a management thing.
It's so hard to do as well, isn't it? It's not an M&A story. It's a lifestyle brand that they've managed very, very well and have sold it to the world as a quintessentially British brand. So, which is...
Burberry.
Indeed.
Not Burberry. Not Mulberry, though.
Not Mulberry.
Yeah, Marvel, did they have results this week? Or,
yes, they did.
They were pretty shocking, weren't they?
Well, it's a year of two halves, isn't it? They had that decision to hike prices, which hit retail sales in the first half, so it didn't really work.
And so they weren't quite as luxury as they thought they were then?
They changed tack, correct me if I'm wrong, but they changed tack within a few months once it came to light that this decision had been like a strategic disaster.
Yeah,
you know, they pulled back, but now it's obviously going to take them a couple of years till they restore their fortunes.
Again, I mean, Mulberry has been around for a long time, and again, it's been on the A market for many, many years. But you know, it was kind of small UK centric business. You know, the business of luxury hadn't gone global in the way it has in the last couple of years. And you know, I think it sort of tried to run before it could walk in respect of actually internationalising at the ultra premium end of the market. And you know, it did exactly the opposite of what I've just said Ted Baker did. We're going to go to China, we're going to charge as much as we possibly can, and you know, we're going to make a huge amount of money. I think they misjudged it.
Isn't there always a danger though with that high end of the market as well, that if you do try and expand internationally, the brand itself tends to lose a bit of cachet?
Well, I don't know. I'm not enough of a connoisseur of luxury brands to understand that. What we do know is that China had a crackdown on luxury gift giving, which coincided with this disastrous decision to raise prices. So, I mean, you know, that chief exec is no longer at the company, and you know, not surprised really.
Yeah,
didn't read the market especially well, one could argue. But there you go. Okay, so some interesting. Reassuringly expensive companies in the results section this week. Couple of AIM classics, actually Majestic's there. They've had a bit of a rough time too, but again, another business which I think, you know, we ought to give the benefit of the doubt. What do you think about Majestic, Alex?
So I think Harriet put them on a sell. They've cut their dividend, which was a very strong selling point.
But they're changing.
They are changing. They bought Naked Wines, which gives them, I think their management said, potentially eightfold greater exposure in the US. So this could be a kind of an inflection point, but I think the shares fell a little bit on the news. Though we've banked profits here. I think this is why Harriet's put Majestic on a sell. So more to come from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a very good example of the quality that AIM has to offer. And you know, for everything I've just said about Mulberry, you know, it is a classic British manufacturer, you know, and it is a success story at AIM. I think you mentioned, Alex, that the shares have risen quite substantially since it came to market. What's the figure?
Mulberry, yeah. So I think they floated in 1996, and it's a fivefold gain off the top of my head since then. Domino's done slightly better, so it's a less premium product, but they're up 1,000% since they floated in 1999. So,
well, I know which I prefer, and it's not handbags. Okay, so thank you, everyone. Lots in the magazine this week. We've only discussed really the tip of the iceberg in terms of the content we've got this week. Simon Thompson has published a great piece, really trying to understand the implications of what's going on in Greece and on the bond markets. You know, we've discussed them very briefly, but it's an incredibly complex issue. I think Simon is less ruffled by what's going on there. Thinks that equity markets still have a bit of life left in them. In the fund section, we're actually continuing the AIM theme. We're having a look at some of the funds that you can use to access that market. Let the experts do the stock picking for you, given it's a stock picker's market. And some of those funds have done exceptionally well. And you know, as we've said, there's rich pickings for them to choose from. I'm sure you'll hear more about that on their podcast later this week. Stock Screen is Momentum this week. Momentum has been a great strategy. And Sector Focus, Jonas Crossan is looking for GPs. And actually the property companies that underpin the UK's massive, massive GP market. Great businesses to be in. Okay, so thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Alex, for your contributions this week. As I said, lots in the magazine, so make sure you go and pick that up this week. Worth Every Penny is the cover story, and Worth Every Penny, the Investors Chronicle, is £4.50. All good news agents. See you next week. Thank you very much.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.